You're listening to Red Eye on Co-op Radio at CFRO 102.7 FM.
When Stephen Harper stood in Parliament last June to deliver an apology for the federal government's role in residential schools, he declared that the nation was ready to share the burden of the past. He vowed that the forthcoming Truth and Reconciliation Commission would establish new relationships embedded in mutual respect that will forge a brighter future. We spoke with Dr. Roland Christjohn right after Harper's speech. He was critical of the very limited powers of the commission, but even more of how Harper's apology evaded the fundamental issue of genocide as defined in international law. And since our conversation, the commission itself seems to have unraveled almost as soon as it began. So we've contacted Dr. Roland Christjohn again. He is in Fredericton, New Brunswick, and we're hoping to discuss the current crisis in the commission and its roots. Welcome back to Red Eye, Roland.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
First, what happened that led to the resignation of the commission's chair, of the Truth and Reconciliation Commission's chair, Harry Laforme?
Well, the details, as far as I can discern them anyway, are fairly sketchy, but what it appears to have happened is that there was first and foremost a conflict in a vision of what the commission was supposed to be achieving, and secondly, the pecking order of the commissioners seemed to not be clear.
What can you tell us about that conflict of vision?
Well, from what I understand, Mr. Laforme was more interested in concentrating on meeting in First Nations communities with residential school survivors and documenting as far as he could the testimony of what happened to them while they were in the schools. And the other two commissioners, and I forget their names right now, but the other two commissioners seemed to want to throw the commission more open to submissions from other peoples that would include people who may not have had anything going on in residential school, may not have visited at all, and may instead have been talking about policies at the policy level or institutional or organizational level of what was happening during the same time period.
And are any of the commissioners known for having any particular affiliations, organizational or with parties?
Yeah. The two commissioners who wanted to throw it more broadly were the ones who were nominated by the Assembly of First Nations and by the federal government. So they came from, they're bureaucrats, and they're coming from a more institutional from an institutional umbrella, as it were. So they're fulfilling somebody else's mandate for what they're there for and what they're supposed to be doing.
Is there any reason that the clarity you've thrown on this isn't very much available in the public arena? It seems to be quite a mystery to, at least I found it such, listening to the limited amount of explanation that was offered.
Well, one of the things you have to realize is that this has got a very, very old history within First Nations community. I mean, Harry Laforme, somebody who I've met on several occasions, being a judge and being from a First Nations background, sees his role more as advocacy for First Nations people, I would imagine. The Assembly of First Nations and the federal government both have reasons to pursue their own ends in the what happens in the Commission on Aboriginal School Truth and Reconciliation Commission. So I imagine they, as career bureaucrats, they treat anything like a career bureaucrat would, which is find the money and protect it as much as you can, and spend it to what you hope to spend it for. I mean, the mark of a good bureaucrat is one who protects his or her budget, or even expands his or her budget. And I think both the Assembly of First Nations and the federal government see, the billions of dollars that are going to go supposedly go into this the entire settlement with First Nations people. That's a fairly large pie, and it's not going to be paid out to individual survivors of the residential school. I mean, you can pretty well calculate that the average will be somewhere between $4,000 and $5,000 for the people who went through residential school, and that's going to leave a sizable pie to be carved up by newly formed bureaucracies, including the Truth and Reconciliation Commission. I mean, you have to calculate that they didn't get an office building in downtown Ottawa for nothing. And the commissioners and the commissioner's staff, they're not doing it out of the goodness of their heart. They're being paid for what they're doing. And just the bureaucracy of setting up the Truth and Reconciliation Commission itself is going to take a sizable chunk out of the settlement money. Well, then the Assembly of First Nations and the federal government are both looking at recouping some of that by being able to legitimize their participation in this process. So it seems to me like Harry LaForme is trying to limit that by saying, well, wait a second, we're not really interested in what federal government bureaucrats say or the Assembly of First Nations people say, particularly since we can't compel their testimony. I mean, suppose somebody from the federal government wants to come, or somebody from the churches wants to testify. What are they going to say that they haven't already said? There is a possibility, however slim it might be, however, but there is a possibility that new people coming up to the commission will have more information or more detail concerning what actually went on in the residential schools.
What are the implications right now for Harry LaForme's resignation for the commission itself?
Well, first thing I would say is that it does call into question what the role of the other two commissioners was to begin with, and whether or not they should stay on with the commission now that LaForme has left. He's making a fair complaint that these people are representing vested interests, and those vested interests are not First Nations survivors. So that's one thing, is the legitimacy of all the commissioners are called into question, and whether or not they should continue is a real issue.
Now, you mentioned about the people who might come before the commission when it was originally conceived. Who would likely be testifying, and who would not?
Well, the people who are going to testify, the only ones who are slated to testify, are First Nations individuals who are former survivors of the residential school. See, this is not a Truth and Reconciliation Commission in the sense of any other Truth and Reconciliation Commission that's ever been held on the planet Earth, and there's been like more than 50 of them already. But in these other commissions, people who were perpetrators of the crimes were, by one way or another, induced or convinced or coerced into testifying about what they had done and the nature and extent of the abuses and so on. That's not happening in this Truth and Reconciliation Commission, which is why I'd say the naming it a truth commission seems a major stretch, since the church is not going to come and talk about what it did and why, or testify to the nature of the abuses, and since the federal government is not going to talk about why they set it up in the first place and what their intention was all along. As I say, genocide has been left out of this discussion entirely. Then all you were going to get from this commission was the testimony of people who'd been in the residential schools, and whoever decided that their hands were clean enough to come in front of the commission and talk about their role, however major or minor it might have been while the residential schools were operational. So you were going to get a fairly limited picture, one, by the way, which is entirely dismissible by the Canadian public. It's easy to see how it could be played out as, well, there those Indians go again, complaining about one thing or another. Well, maybe this will shut them up, and that whole marginalization of First Nation experience will happen again, which is why I didn't like the decommission at all. I don't see how restructuring the commission, bringing back three more commissioners, which is, like I say, likely to be the case in order to have any claim to legitimacy whatsoever. I think they'll have to reconstitute the entire commission. But even reconstituted, it's not going to do anything more than it was already slated to do, which is to hear from people who have legitimate complaints, but not from anybody who is willing to take responsibility for those complaints.
So truth won't come out, and do you think, therefore, reconciliation is really not a tall and accurate term of the conclusion of such a commission, should it proceed along, should it proceed along its original mandate?
Well, again, the reconciliation, let's say a husband and wife split up, and then they get back together, they reconcile. When they were together, they were conciled. To reconcile is to come together again. And one of the difficulties with calling it a reconciliation commission right from the beginning is that the First Nations of Canada were never conciled to what the Settler Society of Mainstream Canada had decided for them. I mean, theft of their property and dispossession and marginalization and extinction. So to say that we were reconciling, I don't see the conciliation that we had in the first place. What's really the federal government and the churches are hoping to do is, first of all, cover up what it was that they did and why they did it. But secondly, they want to create this mythology that there was some wondrous, happy time in the past when the Indians and the settlers lived in some kind of harmony, like a notion of an American Thanksgiving where we're all sitting around a table enjoying a meal together, as if that ever happened in First Nations society and during the time Canada has been in control. We've always been at odds with conflicting agendas. To call what this commission was designed to do was to reconcile is itself another insult, another slap in the face of history.
You have said that the process of what went on in the residential schools, to jump to that, in fact, obscures a deeper underlying policy that qualifies as genocide under the international legal definition. Would you elaborate on that?
Well, yes, there's absolutely no doubt. And as a matter of fact, we can call Canada to testify that what they did was genocide. Because if you check in international law, you find there are three areas under Article 2, three specific regions of actions that qualify as genocide. And Section 2E says very clearly, removing children from one group and putting them under the control of another group is an act of genocide. It's not sort of genocide, but kind of genocide. It's an act of genocide. And so it's undertaking policies to restrict births within a group, and so is causing serious bodily or mental harm to members of the group. Now, when the Genocide Convention was formulated in 1948 in draft form, one thing that people are never taught about international law, that once a draft of an international law is available, it becomes law. So it doesn't matter whether or not the Canadian government ever ratified it, the United States government never did. It was international law from 1948. Now, since there was no international court in 1948, the an initiative was to go as follows, that the individual member nations of the United Nations would ratify the United Nations Genocide Convention in their own criminal code. Canada, and this is attested to in the Hansard and other parliamentary documents, Canada actually had a discussion that if they put the international law into Canadian law as it was, that they would be susceptible someday to an Indian who would learn how to read bringing a charge of genocide against them, and that therefore they were not going to implement the law that they, by the way, with the United States, had forced upon the rest of the world. So you can go and you can check the criminal code today. You're not going to find Article B, D, or E in the international law under Canadian law. So in the Canadian criminal code, they've limited it to those two sections of the international law that they think that they can defend themselves against. They left out these other sections of the Genocide Convention because they knew full well that they would be susceptible to that. The United States knew it so well that they didn't implement the Genocide Convention at all until 1990, and then they made it subject to the constitutional authority of the United States, which also is against international law. You can't exempt yourself from international law, and that's well known. And if you think that maybe we should. Well, if Hitler, for example, had exempted himself from international law, would that have made the Holocaust acceptable? Or Slobodan Milosevic had decided that had simply passed a motion in his parliament that the International Genocide Convention doesn't apply to him. Would he thereby be freed from any kind of worry about prosecution? I don't think anybody would agree that you can make yourself an exception simply by passing a motion in a puppet parliament of some sort. Well, that's exactly what Canada did, however. So, although it was charged with putting into law the full Genocide Convention, it only put in 40% of it. And you can ask a very simple question that I've been asking since I wrote my book on this. What happened to the other 60%? What explanation does the Canadian government have for not implementing 60% of the Genocide Convention, except that we didn't like the fact that we would be prosecutable under it? It's a mistake of some sort, or the secretary who was supposed to type it showed up sick that day, There is absolutely no explanation other than Canada was protecting its own interests when it did this. And like I say, you can check the criminal code today, and you can find genocide is defined in a very limited and specific way in Canadian law.
It's been enlightening again speaking with you both about the current situation with the Commission and, of course, the fundamental issues that underlie its conception. Thank you very much, Roland.
Okay, anytime.
I've been speaking with Dr. Roland Chrisjohn. He's a professor and director of Native Studies at St. Thomas University in Fredericton. He's author of the book The Circle Game, Shadows and Substance in the Residential School Experience in Canada.